Hello, I'm Stephen Fry, a trustee of the Royal Academy of Arts and very proud to be so. Welcome to our podcast.
I'm delighted to introduce this evening's event, a world premiere performance of Psalm, a new work by composer Martin Suckling, co-commissioned by Edmond de Waal and Aura Orchestra. And this collaboration tonight marks the first event in a short series of three concerts called On White. Each of these explores the colour white as inspiration for music, poetry and the visual arts. And it follows the launch of Edmond de Waal's new book, The White Road, this September, and a major project in the Royal Academy Print Room and Library called White. And that project examines white objects and the impact they have on their surroundings and on each other. I know that some of you have had the opportunity to see it this evening. It includes classical Greek statues, a marble lantern by Ai Weiwei, Malevich's suprematist teapot, porcelain pots by Edmond de Waal himself, and things from the Academy's own collections, including Turner's porcelain palette, still with lots of different colours of watercolour on it. As I said, I've been working here for a month, and one of the great privileges, thrills even, of my new job has been sitting at a desk surrounded by the exhibition White. My two favourite things so far, there's a beautiful Joseph Albers print. I always think of Joseph Albers being very colourful, and this is really three shades of white in this print. And then there's also a lovely Mirandi still life in whites and greys. And because I'm tall, I noticed just now that it's at the back of a bookshelf. Some books have been removed to display it. It's at the back of the bookshelf. And because I'm tall, I've noticed that rather appropriately two sheets of white paper have been placed on the shelf to reflect a bit of extra light up onto it. I took over from a chap called Nick Savage, who some of you might know, and as a parting gift for me, he left hanging from my Anglepoise lamp a little tin plate white metal Day of the Dead skeleton. And I'm told on reliable authority by Adam, the Academy's librarian, that at least one of the reviews of Edmund's White exhibition has included this skeleton as a key work in the exhibition. So there's a cautionary tale of some kind there. This evening we'll begin with a world premiere performance of Psalm, performed by the principal players of Aurora Orchestra, followed by an in conversation with Edmond de Waal and Martin Suckling, the composer, led by John Hart, who's chief executive of the orchestra. We'll then have time for questions from you, and then there's a drinks reception in the John Majeski Fine Rooms, which will be through this door. There's also the opportunity to purchase The White Road from the bookshop, for which you want to leave through the door there that you entered by, and Edmond will be signing them for about 15 minutes, but not all evening. So if you want to buy the book, go there before you get a drink. I've been asked to make some acknowledgements on behalf of Edmond de Waal and the Aurora Orchestra. Aurora is one of those words that once you read it too many times, you just can't pronounce it anymore. So I challenge you all after you've had a drink to try to pronounce it. They'd like to firstly thank Martin Suckling for his superb composition. From the orchestra, they would like to thank the conductor, Nicholas Cullen, and the principal players, John Hart and Kate Green. From the Royal Academy, they'd like in particular to thank Christopher LeBrun, Charles Samores Smith, Amy Blewett, Sarah Sanaselli, and Kira Milmo. And from Edmond de Waal's studio, a particular thank you to Narissa Taysom. They'd also like to acknowledge the Lesh Trust and the RVW Trust who've supported this project. Edmund's going to be speaking after the event, so he's not going to say anything now. Just before I hand over to the orchestra, could you make sure your digital devices are all switched at least to silent and ideally off, because if they go off, they'll mildly annoy us, but they'll seriously embarrass you. So I'd now like to hand over to the principal players of the Aurora Orchestra to perform the world premiere of Psalm. Thank you.
I don't know how many world premieres you've been to recently, but I'm totally, totally taken aback by the experience. I know you should be introducing us and talking, John, but I'm putting my oar in straight away. To say that was the most incredible experience. Absolutely extraordinary and wonderful experience, Martin. Well, and what a privilege to be in this extraordinary, extraordinary space with this extraordinary acoustic, listening to your incredible bit of music. I'm totally, totally taken aback by this whole...
Thank you.
So there you go. I'm putting putting my oar in.
Well, I've been
straight
to,
away.
I've been to quite a lot of world premieres, and I've never been to one in such an amazing setting, and and with such an incredible atmosphere of which you all contributed, to tell you the truth, there's something so special about having music played in this room. And particularly, I just went, actually saw the exhibition for the first time just 20 minutes before the concert as well. So the piece was always meant to be in the context of Edmund's work, and to have it in the same building and part of this event is such a privilege.
And that's a point about dialogue, in a sense, between space and music is an interesting route in, I would say, yes. to the first question I had on my list here. Just before I ask that, I thought it might be very, very briefly useful just to set the scene by saying a word about the background to this evening's collaboration and how we came to be sitting here around this table. Back in 2013, at the start of the year, about 3 years ago, we were very fortunate with Aurora to be given the opportunity to work with Edmund as part of a rather wonderful series at the South Bank Centre called The Rest is Noise, which was a kind of year-long survey of 20th century classical music. And we were asked to perform Schoenberg's extraordinary chamber symphony as part of that series. And Edmund was our wonderfully erudite and engaging guide and presenter for that concert, taking the audience by the hand through the streets of pre-war Vienna and illuminating the social, cultural, political landscape into which Schoenberg's work burst in 1913. And we were so bowled over by the experience that we've been desperately hatching plans ever since to try to find a way of working with Edmund again. So it was a huge thrill for us to be asked to be part of the events around the launch of Edmund's book and this wonderful exhibition that many of you will have seen here at the Royal Academy. And I should say that this evening's event is part of a trilogy of events, in fact, the next being on Thursday at King's Place, where we'll be delving a little deeper into the poems of Paul Celan and performing Martin's wonderful work again. There's also an opportunity to hear a very special version of Schubert's Winterreise in December, just before Christmas, which you'll see from your programme happens on the 8th of December. So that's just a little plug for the other elements of this series. But when Edmund mentioned the idea of commissioning a work, our thoughts immediately turned to Martin, who we've admired for many, many years and have often wanted to have a piece written for, and from. And so that it was a serendipitous invitation from Edmund. I wondered maybe if we might start with the question of the creative process, because you may have noticed from your programmes that one of the points you make, Martin, in your introductory note, is how, in a way, you changed your creative process for this piece to, in a sense, reflect Edmund's. And I wondered if you might like to say a few words about that and how you found it.
Sure. Well, this started in a grey day in January earlier this year when I met Edmund for the first time over coffee at King's Place. And he described to me his obsession with white to a certain extent and the book that he was in the process of writing and the collaboration that was taking place with Aurora and John. And I confess, I actually sort of phased out of the conversation because...
Thanks for it. many do,
because what happened with just these sort of initial descriptions of what was going to happen, I had an inkling of Edmund's work before that. I'd read The Hare with the Amber Eyes. I'd sort of Google is a wonderful thing for pulling up images and stuff like that. So I knew where we were coming from. Anyway, just with these sort of first ideas, I suddenly thought, oh wow, wouldn't it be great if we had this situation where you have an instrument go twang and out of this, beautiful colours emerge. Because I was sort of thinking, because I've been told, of course, that the theme was white, the festival was about white, and I was thinking, how do you whiten music? I didn't really know, but I suddenly thought, into a prism and what comes out. And I'm fascinated with the life inside sounds. If you delve inside a timbre, what you discover is actually it's this most fantastic harmony, and there are worlds inside there. And I thought, well, what about a piece that sort of dramatizes this? And so I drew a quick sketch in my book of, it was a piano at that stage, it turned into a harp, a piano and groups of instruments around a space, and sort of handed it over and said, how about this?
And which in terms of the beginnings of collaboration is, I have to say, quite took me aback, because I thought, oh, how lovely, we can settle back into this long collaborative process. You know, but by the time the first flat white had been drunk in King's Place, Martin just handed this piece of paper over saying, so that's it, you know. And it was, but it was a very graphic
thing. Yeah,
you had actually drawn a prism.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I didn't know this at the time, but Edmund said that actually the prism was an important symbol in the book that you'd written. So this all seemed to tie in together. And I thought, great, oh, I can go home. I've got another piece to write, but this will be easy, you know? It's just some nice chords. And then I sat down to write it, and it's not so straightforward, it turned out, because there's the why does one chord follow another, and what happens, and these sorts of things. So I spent some more time with Edmund's work and sort of thought about his process as an artist, and something that I rather envied was that he's able to go into the studio each morning and make something that's to a certain extent finished. Just think, go in, make it, it's done. Amazing. It's probably not as straightforward as that. It is to an outsider, it sort of seems like that.
Not quite.
But you have a thing.
I have a thing.
That you can hold in your hand, and composition, it tends not to work like that at all. It's a very, and the thing suddenly appears at the end. I thought, well, wouldn't it be interesting if I were to try and work in that sort of a way? What if I were to go into my study each morning and make some things with no particular preconceptions as to where they'd be in the piece? I knew the basic principle of what was going to happen, twang, whoosh, okay. Do some of those, explore them, and then arrange them in time in the way that I sort of imagined Edmund to arrange his vessels and his vitrines and things like that. So I did that for a while and had a collection. I actually sort of had a whole bunch of little, I have a little sort of stylus which will draw music staves on paper. So I had like 50 index cards with little sketches on them and descriptions. It's the sort of things that would happen. And then I went, I don't really know what to do with these. So I started at the beginning and wrote a piece from start to finish, because music is, however much it's nice to sort of think you can just place things next to each other, actually, because we experience music as a temporal art, one thing actually really leads to another. And I needed to know, how is this thing going to carry on to the next and on to the next? And then I wrote the piece, and here we are.
But we're here with this harp, and then music in three places.
Yes.
So there is an absolute sense of structure here. I mean, you feel structure in this music in a way that is very profound. And as someone who makes things and puts them out in the world, you know, with a very, very strong sense of structure and of how you move between different things, I was just very taken apart, really, by the sense of movement.
Well,
spatially.
I think one of the things that's so special about playing in an ensemble, I'm a violinist, or singing in a choir, is being inside the music as it's happening. And it's a very visceral experience. And I mean, obviously, I'm not the first person to put players all around you, but I think there's something special about sitting inside and the music happening around you, and you actually feel that you're there, you're part of it happening, which is not the case when everything is just in front of you and you're just listening, I think.
The other element that I think comes strongly from your writing, Martin, about the piece, and also very strongly, Edmund, from the book, is the role of memory in the creative process. And I wondered if that might be interesting just to hear your reflections on memory and creativity. I suppose what comes across strongly to me reading the latest book, Edmund, is to a certain extent the creative process that you describe is in part a sort of homage, doing homage to previous traditions, and in part an act of innovation. So I wondered if that's something that you're very conscious of as you make your ceramics, whether in a sense you're constantly treading a tightrope between innovation and tradition.
I think it's an odd thing, because I sort of seem to inhabit, when I am making, I do inhabit different places and different times simultaneously. So because of the material I use, which is porcelain, which is white, which is a material that is totally alive to history. I mean, for me, it's totally inhabited by a millennia of other people's practice and other places. And it is totally, because it's so seductive, it's like a moment of music. It's totally in the present moment. It's totally performative. It's a happening experience at the same time. So I'm always sort of moving between tenses, between past and present, in as I'm making, and then as I'm trying to bring things into the world and put them around in the world. So it is a homage, but homage implies piety, and there's no remote aspect. I have not one iota of piety in my body. You know, I'm Blakean. You know, drive your cart over the bones of those you love. You know, you have to. But it's there's a wonderful phrase you use. Use that extraordinary phrase of Morton Feldman. It's your line. You have to give it, because it's. But when I read it in your text, which seemed to say exactly this moment of sort of being totally present and in here and totally present in the past simultaneously as a creative act.
So Feldman, it's an extraordinary quotation, I think. You know, he says being a composer is like mourning, something that has to do with, say, Schubert leaving me. I don't actually know quite what he means, but somehow it gets me.
But that idea of, which I think is present actually in your music, of a moment of mourning, mm-hmm. a moment of leaving something behind perpetually, but also discovering something new absolutely at the same time. So it's not melancholy. It hasn't got any melancholy at all in it. Melancholy is the death of art. You know, it's saccharine. It kills what it loves. And it's not melancholic, but it's got mourning. Mourning is much stronger. Mm. So it's got that thing about the past, but it's also leaving the past to actually live in the present. I have to say, when I opened up the what's it called? It's called a score, isn't mm-hmm. it? Open up the score, and it said Psalm after Silan, and the first, what do you call this word?
It's performing direction.
Performing directions. You see, I haven't got any of the language. The first performing directions for Michael Singer are imploring/slash dispassionate. And I thought, what an incredible rubric for art, imploring, dispassionate, having those two words together. So that's me. That's my relationship with the past, imploring, dispassionate. And you?
Well, I think a lot about how music can communicate. I grew up as a violinist, and one of the things I love about music is how it speaks to people without speaking. And I think I share that with a lot of musicians and a lot of people that go to concerts. They want to be communicated with. They don't need to know what it means, but they want to have that sensation of something meaningful happening. And my other life is as an academic, so I guess I think about these sorts of things. I think one of the ways that music constructs meaning is through its relationship to the past, and that musical gestures, musical types, we carry them through culture, and as composers, we can call on them and use them And actually in using them, transform them and make something new. So in a sense, in the larger scale sense, in this piece, the idea of a psalm, which is a musical situation, it is meant to be sung. And in the English choral tradition is sung antiphonally, which fits with the setup that I had here. But the psalms are very interesting because they're often hymns of praise, and they're also often hymns of despair. And having those two things simultaneously, because for me this piece is both joyful and desolate. At the same time, and also I was sort of thinking about, you know, when one offers a prayer, how does one know whether it's been heard or not? And if there were to be a response, how could we possibly understand what it was? And to me, that linked to the two worlds that the harp and the other instruments inhabited. The harp always hits and decays and can only have the 12 equal tempered notes, whereas everybody else has this possibility of breathing in and out and microtonal. So there's this sort of host of connections that I think actually all artworks work with to create their meaning.
It's called Psalm, and it's after Silan, and you've got a harp in the middle. So you have to talk about Silan, you have to talk about Jewishness. I mean, you know, these are the great pivotal hymns of and prayers of the Jewish faith, and you've got a great big bloody harp on stage, and it's about Silan. You haven't set Silan's poems to music, but there is this extraordinary, and I think profoundly beautiful, dialogue with his poetry, this poetry of entreaty and exhalation, and of this poetry of whiteness and of space and of fragmentation and of struggle with language and of despair. Mm-hmm. So, you know, tell me about Silan.
Oh, I mean,
you just have in music, but now you have to say it in words because we're sitting on the stage.
This is tricky because Silan is a terribly difficult poet, and I am not Jewish, and I have not lived through war. I have not seen my parents executed. So one of the things for me when I was dealing with Silan was that sort of how do I find my space, and how can I have a conversation with this person? But of course, it's more universal than that, I think, is what you're saying. These struggles with language, whether it's spoken language or an artistic language, this is the thing that we, as, without wanting to sound too pretentious, but this is what we as artists struggle with every day. How can we do something that is genuinely new, but also genuinely expressive, something that takes you to a place you have never been before, but also takes you by the hand and brings you there? There is such white space in Silan because it's a struggle with how do you express this, and that's what we make baby steps, and we're trying to suggest ways. And I think inviting you into a particular space to have your own thoughts, because I don't know that to narrow things down to a single meaning is to get them completely wrong. I at least from my point of view, and I think it's that we're trying to create a rich space for contemplation, and allow you to experience the world in a slightly different way.
Thanks, Martin. Fascinating, amazing stuff. And do you want to?
I want to go on forever, so I'm probably not allowed to. But I have to talk about titling, because I when. It's this extraordinary thing of sort of sending something into this conversation and then finding that you'd called this piece Psalm, which of course is a Silan title. And I notice, and I know you don't call things randomly, do you? They're not Opus 1 or Untitled 7. You know, things have proper names for you. And titles are really, really important for me. And I just wondered whether we could kind of just forget everyone and just talk about titles just for a minute, if we're allowed to, John?
I love titles.
Good.
And actually, do you know what, if I could imagine calling something Untitled One. In fact, one of my friends at college, we thought we would write a piece called Seminal Work Number 23, because I thought that'd be we're really clever. I don't know if anybody's read A Wizard of Earthsea by Ursula Le Guin. Words and names in these books have the ultimate power. If you know the name of something, then you have, to some certain extent, control of it. You have a power over it. And for me, the naming of a piece has that sort of effect. And I'm never quite sure where it's going to happen within the compositional process. Sometimes it happens after everything's written, but the point where I find a name, and it's the right now, that's it, and I can hold it, I can see it, I can understand what it is, and I stop worrying at that point, because it's suddenly it's real, and the name does that, and it's not a closing down, but somehow it focuses everything. It's a catalyst, or it's a lens which allows the things that I want to happen to happen. And it's also a way of reaching out to other people and to other artworks. Yeah, it's the one way that you can put your hand out and say, well, think of me in terms of this.
Yeah, it's not a bad way of being in the world with other kinds of art or other people you love. You know, you sort of put a hand out and there is someone who you feel some kind of kinship with. I think titling is a hugely significant act. It's not for nothing that naming ceremonies happen everywhere, mm-hmm. in every culture, that naming is a very, very powerful act. And it's also the kind of, in some ways, whenever it happens in the process, it's the last thing you can do for the thing you've made, is to send it out into the world with a name in its pocket, or round its neck, or on the title page, or something. You know, and after that, it's just on its own. It just is on its own, but kind of letting it go with a title. So we now have Celan between us, because Celan, several of my things and exhibitions have Celan titles, have references or moments of Celan in it. So we, another bit of reaching out.
Thank you for listening. For more information about the Royal Academy, please visit www.royalacademy.org.uk.